Hey everyone, it's me, Debbie Kamau Bell. Welcome back to the ACLU's podcast, At Liberty. And of course, I'm your host. Every episode, I'm asking the big questions on the big issues affecting our big country, especially questions affecting our hardest hit and most vulnerable communities. And I'm calling on experts from the ACLU and beyond. And they're going to give me lots of guidance. As you all know, I need lots of guidance. Last episode, we covered the current state of disability rights and envisioned a more sustainable, thoughtful care system. If you listened, you know that we talked about the 504 sit-in. In 1977, a group of disabled protesters occupied a federal building in San Francisco for a record-breaking 25 days. These activists were brave and they were vocal, and they knew that their right to speak up could lead to their civil rights. We're recording this on Monday, March 24th, and today we're exploring that First Amendment right to free speech with a focus on the case of Mahmoud Khalil. Khalil is a recent Columbia University graduate student, activist, soon to be father, and legal permanent resident of the United States of America. That part is super important. And on March 8th, he was unlawfully detained by ICE because of his speech in support of Palestinian rights. He is now on trial for exercising his voice, and that should alarm us all, no matter what side of the political aisle you're on. All right, everybody, this is a big one. Let's take a breath. You got this, and the ACLU's got you. Let's get into it. We have two guests joining us today, because this is a big issue, so we need two experts. Ben Weisner is the director of the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. He works to protect and expand the First Amendment freedoms of expression, association, and inquiry. And little known fact, me and Ben had dinner probably 15 years ago before I was So he's a nice guy. He met with an unknown comedian. He's also working to ensure that civil liberties are enhanced rather than compromised by new advances in science and technology. Bahar Azmi is the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He directs all litigation around issues related to the promotion of civil and human rights. Hey, welcome to the show, Ben and Bahar. So first of all, thank you for being here. Personally, I have been very interested in the case of Mahmoud Khalil, so I'm very excited to talk to the both of you about this. To me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this seems like a very scary tipping point, and I'm actually happy. I'm happy it's recorded, but I would want to have this conversation even if there wasn't a podcast. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure. I agree. This is a pivot point in this moment, a chance for us to understand the broader stakes about this individual target and what it means for the rest of us. So I'm happy to be here talking about it.
Thank you. Ben, what's your thought?
I think we keep on ending up at the bottom of a new slippery slope. You know, look, I started at the ACLU a month before 9/11. So it's not a first rodeo when it comes to things that I never thought would happen in this country. But this, add this to the list of cases that I did not think that I would have to be involved in the United States of America. Someone to whom we've given lawful residence, being ripped from his family with the goal of ripping him from the country for nothing more than speech, which the president disagrees with. That doesn't feel like America, and I hope the courts will agree.
I agree. I really hope that, yeah, hope seems like too small of a word, I guess, but like, because it seems like if they don't agree, I don't know that this is the country that we were told it was that when we were in school. So, yeah, I feel the same way. First of all, just start, I usually start by asking guests how they're doing, but that seems like sort of an insignificant question considering what you're engaged in. So, and I don't know how much direct contact you have with Mahmoud, but how is Mahmoud doing?
Yeah, so we, as a result of our initial kind of emergency motion before the federal judge in New York, we secured promise of robust counsel access. I wouldn't say robust, but at least counsel access. So we're able to schedule video calls with him, his legal team, and have been talking to him periodically. How is he doing? I would say, despite the incredible shock and trauma of this sort of evening abduction and spiriting away of 1,500 miles away, the dark of night, despite the intense fear and anxiety the family has with Noor, his wife is 8 months pregnant, and the kind of existential terror about possibly being incarcerated when their first child is born. And aside from the political weight he has been carrying and that's been forced upon him, including by you know, the entire apparatus of the United States government, despite of all of that, I think he is resilient and strong, managing, staying positive, which is, I didn't know him before, but which is consistent with everything that we've heard about Mahmoud in general, and his sort of empathic, thoughtful leadership role on the Columbia campus. So all things considered, he's doing okay, and is focused and strong.
I'm always blown away by the resilience of our clients. Bahar and I have both represented people who were tortured in CIA black sites, who were locked away in Guantanamo at first without lawyers. And it's just amazing when you talk to these people, how much they focus on making sure that others don't get stuck in the same kind of position, how much they focus on the details of the legal cases that we're bringing and really wanting to understand how we're trying to use the same system that locked them up to get them out and to get justice for them.
Yeah. And I want to ask one more thing, because it's hard to sort of know what is true and what is not true. But I've heard there's been a sense of Mahmoud building community with the people he's incarcerated with. Like, I've heard about commissary and things. Is that, how much of that is that actually happening, or is that true?
Yeah, I mean, in the limited context, social contexts that are available to someone who's in, you know, private ICE detention facility, he does seem to have a communal life. He, in his public letter, he noted that even though he's the target of this persecutory action, that there are so many other immigrants there who in detention who've been there for months, thousands of miles away from family. And he's both sort of recognized the broader systemic horrors of immigration detention, and I think found strength and solidarity in the, you know, camaraderie and the fellowship he has with colleagues he's made.
And we can't help but also talk about his wife, Dr. Noor. How is she doing? 8 months pregnant is not a time to not be able to rely on your partner who you've gone through this whole thing with. How is Dr. Noor doing?
I think similarly shocked and traumatized. Maybe some of you all have seen the really heart-wrenching video of that she took watching, you know, armed federal agents barge into their apartment building and, you know, physically kidnap. That's the word she uses. And if you see the video, that's looks like an accurate description. Kidnap her husband, not knowing where he would be sent or if she would see him again. So I think we can't underestimate the trauma that that will leave with her, particularly in this moment of vulnerability. And she's able to communicate with Mahmoud, which is a huge relief. She has a beautiful support community, the university. You know, we saw her on Friday. She's naturally scared and anxious, but also remarkably resilient and courageous and finding meaning and peace wherever she can in this experience.
I have seen the video, which I think it does put it in stark relief exactly how awful this had to be. And if I'm understanding that people who kidnapped him didn't identify who they were with or who they were representing, is that true?
They didn't give their names and they didn't show a warrant, but I think it was clear that they were with ICE.
I think it was also clear, and I've heard this informally from people in government, that they didn't know when they showed up at their apartment that he had a green card. They thought that he was there on a student visa. But as with everything else this administration did and does, instead of backing down, they doubled down. And they took a case that was a major affront to civil liberties and made it potentially a catastrophe for civil liberties, because they've now invoked an argument that I would, again, not expect to see in this country, that the Secretary of State can single out any one of the 12 million lawful permanent residents of this country, people with strong ties to this country, and say, that's it. You're out of here. You have to leave your family, your job, your community, because I've determined that your presence here interferes with the president's foreign policy. So, that error made a very important case one of the more vital cases that I've ever been involved in.
That's right. You sort of map the incompetence with venality, and we get this toxic brew, because they did show up and announce that his visa is being revoked, and his wife calmly went to the apartment and showed them a green card, and they sort of fumbled and stumbled and said, well, that's being revoked too. And that was it. And as Ben said, that made a minor catastrophe into a major legal catastrophe.
Yeah, I don't think that's, that was something I was not aware of. And again, I think even those of us who, I feel like I'm following the case fairly closely, but even those who are following it, it is so twisty and turny and complicated, and also so head-scratchingly hypocritical in so many ways that at that moment, those law enforcement officers could have been like, oh, hold on a second, let's go back and check this. And then we're talking about a different thing. We're not talking about this. So that, and we always have this sort of like good apple, bad apple. The good apples have to stand up to the bad apples thing in law enforcement. And so many times you feel like it is the banality of people in those positions that sort of allows injustice to prosper.
Yeah. One other relevant fact to this sort of how far up this goes and how political this is Mahmoud Heard, the ICE agents taking calls from the White House, unspecified, but this was all happening in real time. The sort of improvised like authoritarianism on the fly.
Improvised authoritarianism on the fly. That's where we're at. Wow. Mm-hmm. So for people who've only seen Mahmoud Khalil's name passing in headlines because there's so much news going on right now, can we get what are the basics of the case and how he ended up sort of under the watchful eye of the Trump administration in the first place?
Well, sure. Maybe I'll give some of the background. Bahar, you can give some of the details of the legal proceedings. But I think the whole world has seen that Columbia University has been a locus of very intense protests since October 7th. And Mahmoud Khalil is a Palestinian human rights activist who was very, very involved in those protests. In fact, became a student leader of those protests, by many accounts, a mediator of those protests, someone who helped negotiate between the student activists and the university during a very, very fraught time, but also certainly involved in protests that were quite controversial to many in the Columbia community and outside the community. And the Trump administration made very clear when it came into office with a series of executive orders that it was going to target supporters of what it considered to be pro-Hamas, anti-Semitic speech with a great, great deal of scrutiny. And at that point, you started to see some outside groups highlight specific members of the community and suggest to the Trump administration that these were the leaders of the protest movement and these were the people that the Trump administration should target. So it was certainly the case. Now, one other feature of Mahmoud Khalil is that while many protesters on that campus wore masks precisely so they couldn't be identified, he always made a point of not wearing a mask and being outspoken and open about his role in advocating against the war and for human rights. And that's another reason why I think he was early on identified as a target here.
Yeah, and he is the number one target for what the Trump administration has said will be many more of these kinds of cases to come, which have in fact happened with other Palestinian-aligned students at Georgetown and Columbia and other universities. And so after his arrest, his immigration attorneys filed emergency papers with the federal court in New York for a petition for habeas corpus saying his detention was unlawful. At that time, though, the ICE officials were moving him around various jurisdictions in, some manipulation of the court system. So, by the time Sunday came, he was arrested Saturday, he was already flown to Louisiana. And the government has continued to argue that the courts in New York or New Jersey cannot hear his case. The case must stay in Louisiana, which the government uses for a number of reasons, not least the law in that judicial district is highly, highly conservative and deferential to the executive branch, particularly on immigration matters. So they want to keep him out of the New York and New Jersey courts. And the legal case has been moving very quickly. And there are sort of a number of questions at issue. One, demanding that he, in fact, be physically returned to the New York, New Jersey area. Two, that he be granted bail or bond because he is no flight risk whatsoever. And then three, ultimately, that his detention would violate the Constitution. It would violate First Amendment protections against governmental retaliation for a particular viewpoint and would violate due process protections that guarantee one isn't punished or incarcerated by virtue of guilt by association or under, as Ben can talk about, this incredibly broad foreign policy invocation of executive immigration power.
One irony, Kamau, is, I mean, the inauguration day already seems like three lifetimes ago.
Yes.
But on his first day in office, one of the executive orders that Trump signed supposedly promoted freedom of speech and said that we are against censorship, that every member of this administration will promote and defend the First Amendment. And we have not seen in my lifetime an administration or a president with such consistent, pervasive hostility towards the First Amendment, who has at every turn tried to shut down any power center in society that might hold him in check. And you know, this case is really squarely in the middle of this. The message here is, if you're in this country, even if you're here lawfully, even if we've done a background check, even if we decided that you get to live here permanently, unless you toe the line, unless you are willing to kiss the ring, unless you're willing to silence yourself, your status here is in jeopardy. And remember, that's not just tragic for people like Mahmoud who get swept up into this system. That is actually depriving everybody in this country of the right to hear speech that might dissent from the party line. If everyone is living under this kind of chill, everyone who's visiting us, and that includes not just students, but scholars, doctors, lawyers, professionals, if they all feel that unless they wear their MAGA hats, they're going to be deported, it's going to completely impoverish the environment for all of the rest of us as well. And that's why these cases are so, so important.
Yeah. And in addition to the sort of false flag of free speech that this administration is indulging or attempt to indulge in with the utmost hypocrisy, there's the other false flag of trying to prevent or protect against anti-Semitism coming from an administration that a president who aided and abetted neo-Nazis storming the Capitol to overturn the election in the name of white supremacy and who called avowed white supremacists and neo-Nazis marching in Charlottesville very fine people. So one has to wonder why Mahmoud's alleged anti-Semitism, which is, we can talk about this, absolutely preposterous in the extreme based on everyone who knows him. But in any event, that anti-Semitism from a Palestinian human rights activist, alleged anti-Semitism, is a threat to the foreign policy of the United States, but not having a lot of neo-Nazis in your cabinet, that's all fine.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember when they were mad that college campuses weren't allowing, and I can put air quotes, conservatives to have free speech on college campuses. And that was the whole thing about, we need more free speech on college campuses. And now to see it be so blatantly about, oh, no, you just wanted to protect that specific type of speech, yeah, not free speech generally.
And this is of a piece with the assault on the universities themselves. Mm-hmm. The Trump administration said to Columbia, we're going to take away $400 million and we won't even talk to you. We won't even negotiate with you about how you might get it back unless you agree to put an academic department under receivership and change the course offerings, change your admissions process, change your discipline process, ban the wearing of masks on campus. All of these things aimed right at the free speech rights of that community, aimed at Columbia's First Amendment right to decide what kind of academic community it wants to be. Again, under a banner of free speech. I mean, it's beyond ironic. And I think it needs to be said here that Colombia's response to this, which was apology and capitulation, rather than fighting back, even though those orders were completely illegal, and I think courts would have blocked them, only emboldens the administration to keep up these kinds of attacks. If the privileged, powerful institutions in our society are unwilling to stand up for free speech, how should we expect others? Why are we placing this burden on a non-citizen who is here on a green card, who now has to carry on this fight that Colombia itself won't even take on?
Yeah, to this idea that the conservatives were appalled that there was an absence of free speech on campus. We sort of can't underestimate the powers of projection. I mean, who are the real snowflakes here? it was never really about free speech. It was, as always, from their sort of authoritarian instincts to have things said that they agree with. And now that they're in power, to use the full force of the United States government to enforce that ideological viewpoint.
Yeah, I think you both have done a great job of, like, the question is like, well, if I'm not a Palestinian activist, why should I care about this case? But you've made it clear that, like, this is not just about, because if they're just targeting speech they don't like, and in this case, it's a speech of a Palestinian activist, but it could be somebody who's talking about reparations, or somebody who's talking about LGBTQ plus rights, or somebody who's talking about, any number of things they don't like.
Let's not talk about what it could be. I mean, let's talk about what it already is. I mean, in the same month that we're working on this Khalil case, we're seeing executive orders targeting specific law firms because they represented the president's political opponents, or because they did voting rights litigation that the administration didn't like. We saw an executive order recently that attacked the entire legal profession for taking on important cases on immigrants' rights and other issues. We're litigating against the National Endowment for the Arts, which said if you want to apply for an arts grant, you need to certify that you will not promote gender ideology, whatever that means. We're representing research scientists whose important medical research was scrubbed from government-run websites because it had naughty words like LGBT in it. So you cannot look at this case in isolation, and you don't need to engage in hypotheticals, because we have already seen a really, really ferocious attempt to stifle disfavored ideology across our entire society already in just a few short months.
Yeah, I quite agree. It's like an ideological neutron bomb they've dropped in government that's sort of like leaving the physical structures in place, but peeling out any kind of messaging, not even necessarily advocacy, just sort of words or ideas that the administration finds unacceptable to be a part of civil discourse, which is pretty terrifying. And then, following the models of Orban and Modi, I think, it's been suggesting civil society is absolutely next. Legal organizations, grassroots advocacy organizations operating in every area you mentioned, Kamau. It's not clear how they would want to use the leverage of the United States government to go after civil society, but I think it's not surprising they started with big law, because if you can convince major institutions, as Ben was saying, like Columbia or some of the biggest law firms in the country to bend the knee, then who next would dare stand up? And really, if big law is gone, who's going to help support the ACLU and and CCR when they come after us?
So you both bring up an interesting point. Anybody who's associated with Mahmoud Khalil's case is basically putting themselves in the target of the government, too. So you could have had the choice to run from this case screaming, like, no, 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 no. How did you two both get connected to this case, and who else is on on Khalil's team?
I want to just say, before we get into that, I think, Bahar and I both know human rights lawyers in other countries. Human rights lawyers who, when they get into an elevator, have to worry about who the next person is who's going to get into the elevator, because their lives are in danger. And it has never been like that to practice human rights law in the United States, and it still isn't. And the kinds of risks that we're talking about are, for the most part, I think, not risks to our lives and safety, and I want to contextualize that. We still are members of a powerful profession. And we work for powerful institutions. And we came into this profession because we wanted to defend the rights of others, and we'll do that. And really, I hope if other lawyers are listening to this, they understand, you know, these are the times for which they're going to be judged. These are the actions for which they're going to be judged. And the lawyers who are bending the knee and who are capitulating are writing the first paragraphs of their own obituaries. And I want to say that as in very, very strong terms, right? We have a privilege and we have a responsibility. Right now, our court system is still functioning. And we've seen federal courts in case after case stand up against some of the worst legal violations that we've seen. Maybe that won't continue to hold. I think it will. And we have to keep bringing those cases to the courts. But I don't want to make us the center of the story here. I don't feel, you know, personally targeted, threatened in the way that Mahmoud Khalil was, or in the way that some of my colleagues in other countries and other societies have been. And I don't want to give any lawyer in our society, particularly a big law lawyer, you know, such an easy way out of doing what is really required of them at this moment.
Yeah, I think recognizing the significance of this case, we've had sort of an amazing collaboration between his immigration lawyer and actually a lawyer for Mahmoud in his disciplinary case against Colombia named Amy Greer, the Center for Constitutional Rights and the CLEAR Project at CUNY, the National ACLU, who's expert on First Amendment and due process issues, and the New York Civil Liberties Union, who shares that expertise, and a professor at NYU, Alina Doss, who's an immigration expert and actually litigated and won a similar case on behalf of an activist, Ravi Ragbir, who won a case challenging his removal as retaliation for his activism. And now the case is in New Jersey. The ACLU from New Jersey has joined in as well. So it's a very big and powerful team, thankfully. And he also has immigration lawyers who have experience in the intersection of immigration and national security.
And how did you two get connected with the case?
For me, one of my colleagues was in touch with a classmate, Kyle, who was Mahmoud's original immigration attorney. So got on a couple of calls on Sunday, understood the stakes, and immediately decided to jump in on the very first emergency petition we filed with the federal court on Monday morning that led to a big press conference and an amazing rally of what seemed like 800 or 1,000 supporters outside the courtroom. Of course, this is right up the ACLU's alley. So they were going to be natural partners, as well as CUNY CLEAR, who, you know, works on FBI and ICE related suppression, particularly of Arabs and Muslims in the post 9/11 era.
We're a very connected public interest legal community. Many of the lawyers working on this case have worked together on many cases under this president and other presidents in the past. And that allowed this team to get up to speed very quickly.
You mentioned this earlier, Bahar, about the idea of like, this is not, you know, he's been accused of, that Mahmoud has been accused of anti-Semitism. And you're saying it's not the case, I guess. And so please feel free to talk more about that. And also can talk generally about how this is just a clear violation of First Amendment rights.
So the anti-Semitism, it's really complicated to have to deal with that, because it's just rolled out as a smear and a trap. Mm-hmm. And so it's just the farthest thing from his worldview. He believes in the sort of interconnectedness and freedom of Jews and Palestinians. He is committed to Palestinian human rights, which is falsely and smearily associated with a derogatory view of Jews, of anti-Semitism, which is a really dangerous conflation. But sort of more to the point, I think as a number of letters from Jewish teachers and fellow Jewish students that were submitted as part of his bail application showed, he is a loving, humane, caring person. And I think in the words of one letter that was particularly resonant from a Jewish student, she wrote, "Mahmoud Khalil did more to protect me as a Jewish student than Columbia University ever did."
Mm. You know, I want to also be careful here, because I do think we need to distinguish what's going on in the court of public opinion from what needs to go on in the court. Now, in the court of public opinion, he's been branded a Hamas supporter. Now, you can be sure that not just the government, but many other people in society who are motivated to put that narrative forward have combed through every single public word that he's ever spoken. And I have yet to see a single shred of evidence linking him to anti-Semitism or support for Hamas, the terrorist organization. The reason why I say I want to be careful here is that even if he did speak at a rally supporting Hamas's violent acts against Israel, he would still be protected by the First Amendment. What the government is able to prescribe is material support for a designated terrorist organization. He's not allowed to do a fundraiser for Hamas, but certainly the First Amendment allows any of us to advocate for very, very controversial causes. And so I don't want to end up in a public discussion that sort of says that the legitimacy of his case, the danger of the government's position turns on whether he ever said something offensive or not. Because again, as a First Amendment advocate, I routinely represent people whose views I find offensive. In fact, you're only a First Amendment advocate if you're willing to do that. Everyone thinks that they know what free speech is and they support it. Most people are wrong about both. They don't know what it is. They think that it applies to their tweet being taken down by a private company. And they don't support it because as soon as speech intrudes onto the things that are most precious to them, they say, well, no, that's not free speech. That's hate speech. Oh, no, that's not free speech. That's misinformation. Oh, no, that's not free speech. That's anti-Semitism. All of those things are free speech. And until the day when you stand up to defend the speech rights of someone who deeply offends you, you have never actually supported free speech.
Well, and it's, well, when you say all that stuff, I'll go, as someone who's made a living throughout my career as a stand-up comedian, I know a lot of people say offensive things and get paid for those things and would not be able to get paid if they didn't say offensive things. So,
no, and I'm sure you get a lot of emails afterwards saying, I liked everything that you did except for that one joke, but that's not free speech.
Right? Yeah, take that one joke out and then you're fine. Yep. And eventually, if you take all those one jokes out, you're left on stage with nothing. So. So I understand the idea that free speech covers all speech. But here's a question that I think also people don't understand, and I don't know the answer either. Do you have to be a citizen of the United States of America to be covered by free speech in America?
You don't. Now, look, it's obviously the First Amendment doesn't really extend to every person on the planet outside the country. And when we have brought cases, for example, when the U.S. has excluded foreign scholars because of their speech, we've represented people here in the U.S. and said it's actually their right to hear the speech that's being implicated. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty clear that once you're here, once you are in the United States, maybe a better way to think about it is the First Amendment is a constraint on government. The First Amendment says to the government, you cannot take retaliatory punitive action against someone who is here on U.S. soil simply because you disagree with a viewpoint or position that's been advocated. That is certainly true for someone to whom we've extended permanent residence. We've said you're a permanent member of this community. I think it's also true for people who are here on student visas. And there's a reason why people come from all over the world to our colleges and universities. It's not only because they are some of the most prestigious in the world and have achieved rightful global prominence. It's because of their commitment to free speech, free debate, tolerance. And what we're doing now is we're essentially setting fire to, this whole tradition of our trying to say to the best and the brightest people all around the world, come here. This is where you should develop into a future leader of our society or your society. This is where you can be exposed to other ideas, be challenged. It's the whole identity of a university. 12 months from now, if the courts have not stood up for these fundamental freedoms, universities are going to be something completely different. We're going to be shut off from learning so many things about the rest of the world that may offend our tender sensibilities, but are really, really vital for the future leaders of America to hear firsthand.
So is there anything that is not covered by free speech? I think generally you hear people in bars go, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater.
That's what the thing they mean, by the way, is you can't falsely yell fire in a crowded theater, because I would hope that if there was a fire in a crowded theater, someone would say fire.
I'm afraid I'm not allowed to yell it. I don't want to be arrested for yelling fire in a crowded
theater. Look, yeah, of course there are exceptions, and the exceptions are narrow, and they need to be. In our system, the First Amendment doesn't protect you if you incite imminent violence against someone else. If you stand in front of a fired up crowd and say, go attack those people. The First Amendment doesn't protect you, harassment, which we consider to be conduct more than speech. So even if a offensive message is fine, if it's held up on a banner, if you put it on a particular student's dorm room door and target it in that way, we might regard that as conduct rather than speech. Defamation is a narrow category of speech. In some circumstances, you know, lying about something that someone else did can create reputational harm. But again, these are narrow exceptions. We have the broadest speech rights of any country on the planet. And it actually has served us fairly well. You know, I also will say here that this is an issue where the courts have not been that partisan. Even a very conservative judiciary has generally been quite protective of speech rights. So I actually have some hope in all the cases that I've talked about today that there's a good chance that these courts are going to get this right, because the courts understand that whatever rule they make is going to be applied by someone other than them. If you let hateful speech be punished, in one case, it's going to be a sheriff in Alabama applying that rule. And in another case, it's going to be the San Francisco School Board. And they're going to have a very different idea of what crosses that line into hate speech. And for that reason, we've had pretty strong bipartisan judicial support for free speech, even as we've always had pretty strong bipartisan hostility towards free speech among the public.
I laughed, chuckled a little bit, because you said, like, you can't give a speech and say, go attack those people over there, because it sounds familiar to me. Something. I'll just leave it at there.
I think we can say, at a minimum, Trump has come pretty close.
Yeah. Okay.
There's another norm that I think is worth introducing here that's kind of adjacent to the First Amendment, which is, you know, the principle that one isn't culpable through guilt by association. This is in periods of sort of high stress or an asserted existential military threat, which in this case is entirely made up. Here, Palestinians or immigrants, it's very customary for the government that did it in the Red Scare and during McCarthyism to suggest that this existential but unseeable threat is everywhere, and so anyone might be a part of it, and that therefore it's okay in going after the sort of the broader movement to single anyone out who's even remotely connected to the movement. So the principle is there has to be individualized guilt and not just an assumption that because you are near a protest with people who share the same general goals, that your conduct can be criminalized.
So recently we had an episode about on immigration rights, and Mary Bell Hernandez Rivera and Lee Gillert explained that many immigrants who think their statuses are secure, or who our statuses are secure, like Mahmoud's, you would think this says I can be here, are now afraid that their status is not as secure as they believed. And are now people are obviously, can you sort of,
and that's the point.
Also talk about
The point of McCarthyism was not just to haul one person before a congressional committee, and question that person about fake ties to communism. The point was for everyone to imagine being hauled in front of that committee. The point here is not just to isolate Mahmoud Khalil, in a jail in Louisiana. The point is to communicate to the millions and millions of other people who share his status that it would be wise for them to stop talking, that they should not criticize the leader, that they should not advocate for causes that the leader opposes, because it could be them next. That's the unmistakable message. Just as the point of going after one law firm is not just to annoy a particular lawyer who took on the administration, but to tell everyone else in the legal profession, we can destroy your business if you take on a case against this administration. And if you bring before the judges evidence of our illegality or misconduct. And so that's why you know, the societal response to this cannot be apology and capitulation. It has to be locking arms because this stuff doesn't work if everybody joins together to oppose it. And it works very well if people or groups can be singled out and isolated from the herd.
Well, I appreciate that. And that's the thing about it that sort of connect that I sort of initially responded to is like, if this is happening to this person under these circumstances, that can eventually come for all of us if we don't look like we fall in line with whatever the party line is. And part of this is about like how, and you talked about this earlier, how Khalil was arrested and detained, like specifically like, you know, and his wife going to get his green card. And how has that all played out since then? Like, I would imagine that Dr. Noor is like, once he's gone, is like, what do I do next? You know, how to, you know, I know, call the lawyer, but literally, like, how's his wife's experience been with like DHS and ICE and those in those people?
Yeah, I mean, just the whole thing is, you know, has been really quite traumatic in the first few days, especially when there was just massive uncertainty. You know, it's a terrifying experience. And, you know, not just for the Khalils. I think what the video captured is an experience that, you know, thousands of people experience, having, you know, armed immigration officials with the power to arrest you and send you 1,500 miles from your family is a terrifying scenario. So I, you know, one thing I appreciate about Noor and Mahmoud is that their recognition that even though they're being specifically targeted, they're not alone in suffering the shock and abuses and uncertainty that the immigration detention system is deliberately designed to create. I mean, this government is opposing his bail application. I mean, it's just the United States government wants to keep him incarcerated for months while his wife gives birth to his firstborn child, when under their own terms, there's no criminal record. He's not remotely a flight risk. Can you, you know, imagine the venality and the cruelty of that kind of a practice and lawyers going into court to demand that he stay in jail rather than be with his family?
You know, I want to say here, part of the goal of this strategy, this shock and awe, this flooding the zone, Friday night executive orders, Saturday night arrests in the middle of the night, is to keep us on our back heels, to make us feel like we're helpless in the face of this onslaught. And just when we get our footing in response to the latest outrage, they come with another one, and then another, and then another. And look, it's partly my job to say this, but I sincerely believe it. We can resist this. There are still powerful institutions in society. We are one of them that have been around for a long time and that have been through episodes like this, maybe not with the same kind of pace, velocity, and cruelty. But we have been through really terrible times in our country. And look, law can't solve these problems. Law isn't a substitute for political resistance and political response. What we can try to do is mitigate the worst cruelties, is to throw some sand into the gears and to give the rest of the society time to get their bearings, catch their breath, and respond politically, respond with elections, respond with other kinds of activism. So listen, this is the message. It's pretty dark. It may get darker. But if your response to this is helplessness, you're giving the president more power than he actually has.
Oh, I think that's an incredibly important point. And I would add another point of maybe not optimism, but contrast, because, you know, Ben and I were both involved in the responses to the human rights crisis created by the Bush administration after 9/11. And there were just a few legal organizations resisting and filing cases when sort of mainstream America really had a lot of tolerance for some of the repressive practices of the Bush administration. But there was nobody in civil society that was particularly well organized in the early years. You know, Trump talks about registering Muslims. You know who actually registered Muslims? You know, George W. Bush, thousands of them, and swept up hundreds of Muslims in Brooklyn and Queens and put them in immigration detention and tried to use secret hearings. The point is, at that time, there was really no kind of mass resistance. But in the 10, 15 years since, grassroots movements have grown in so many of these critical spaces. I mean, it used to be I was like the only Muslim in the room in these cases. Now there are dozens of Muslim-led civil society organizations, dozens of grassroots immigration rights organizations. You just used to be the ACLU. Now, and that mobilization is and in support of Palestinian human rights. So between sort of actions in the courts and political mobilization of the kind Ben is talking about, I agree, we do have the power to resist.
So we're going to end this on the lightning round. Couple last questions, and we'll just go back and forth, starting with you, Ben. If listeners remember one thing from this conversation, what should it be?
That this case is not just about Mahmoud Khalil. That this case is about the right to dissent. And the right to dissent always involves speech that is offensive to political majorities, even. And if you find yourself saying, I'm a strong free speech supporter, but this is a little too far for me, think again.
Yeah.
The one thing that I've seen is the power and possibility of mobilization around cases like this, and using this as a teaching moment, a moment for resistance, and a moment for mobilization around values we all care about. This case is getting a lot of attention because I think many people see as Ben has just emphasized, it's not just about Mahmoud, it's about all of us. It's about the, you know, basic principles of a constitutional republic.
And if listeners do one thing from this conversation, what should it be, Ben? There's one thing a person listener does.
Again, I think supporting civil society organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU is so important at times like these because we're the ones who are able to bring these injustices to courts, and courts are still functioning in this country. But beyond that, please don't wait for the law to fix things. I think when Trump was president the first time, people waited for a prosecutor to save us. When he was out of office, they waited for a different prosecutor to save us. That's not going to work. The only solution to what we're going through right now is for it to be repudiated by a strong political majority. So be part of that majority.
I was just going to agree with Ben that lawyers play a critical defensive role, but really what all we can be doing is opening up space for people to engage in politics and resistance, like in the streets, in local elections, in town halls. People can't be seen to acquiesce to this. And there is mass power in these moments to mobilize people.
So last, and this is a classic ACLU question here, because right now people are wanting to step out into the, into the arena and advocate for a cause they believe in. They might even want to advocate for Mahmoud Khalil specifically. What are their rights? What should they be mindful of if they join a public protest? And what should you do or not do if you're arrested or detained? This seems like it's right down Ben alley. I'm getting
it is. And, I have to say, normally this is a very straightforward question for me. In the context of today's conversation, it's a very painful question for me.
Yeah.
Because if my friend or relative who does not hold a U.S. passport came to me and said, should I participate in this mass mobilization rally this weekend? I would unfortunately have to pause before answering, before telling that person to put her own body and status on the line. And that is so painful to have to say. So let's first of all start with people who don't have that particular vulnerability. Get out there. We have incredible Know Your Rights materials on the ACLU website that you can find. And I have no reason to think that the courts, again, even in the face of these challenges, will be anything other than fully protective of the right to engage in mass nonviolent protest of policies that we disagree with. If you are a non-citizen, particularly if you're a student here on a visa, and you decide that there are other ways for you to contribute to this resistance other than putting yourself at risk of arrest and removal and being sent out of this country, no one's going to judge you at a time like this, just because these are really scary times.
Bahar, what's giving you hope right now?
What's giving me hope was, I think, coming out of the courtroom in Khalil's case and seeing 1,000 people demanding justice for him and showing up in, you know, one of the more concentrated ways in the after the election we've seen a long time, and knowing that this case can really hopefully leverage a conversation about how serious, how dangerous the administration's actions are, but also the possibility that with, you know, collective organizing and smart lawyering, fair and impartial judging, we can win.
Same, Ben, what's giving you hope right now?
You know, it's a privilege to be able to work in a place like this on really hard days. You know, I've been in the ACLU offices twice the day after Trump won an election, where everyone else in my world is shattered and broken and immobilized. And everyone in my office is rolling up their sleeves and saying, let's do this. Let's get to work. This is what we're here for. This is why we've been around for 100 years. It's our time. And so just seeing my colleagues both in this organization and in the public interest legal community in general, just do the work. And when they finish filing one brief, turning and saying, what's next? What do we have to do next? What do we have to do next? Is so unbelievably inspiring that I feel sorry for people who don't get to be surrounded by that on a day-to-day basis.
Nice. Where can listeners keep up with you and your work, and how can they show support for Mahmoud Khalil?
Well, I think listeners know to go to aclu.org. If they try to find me on social media, they will find a big blank because I retired from that about 6 or 7 years ago because it was making me dumber, Kamau.
So, good job. You did the right thing. You did the right thing. I'm not going to applause for your mental health concerns.
I'm sorry. Yes. I'm sorry. It really was. It really was. So yeah. just follow the ACLU on all of the social media platforms that you think are important in your life, even though they're not.
Yeah, same. So you can follow us at ccrjustice.org, and we publicize events, rallies, actions that people can take. So follow us on social media, even if Ben won't.
Ben refuses to follow you. He'll open up an account just to follow you.
Well, he can pick up the phone. It's okay.
Yeah, that's true. And how can we support Mahmoud Khalil?
On our respective social media and organizational sites, there are lots of ways to, you'll see, to show up and support Khalil.
Including taking action, signing letters and petitions. Yeah. We've seen millions of signatures gathered by different organizations. Mm-hmm. And believe me, that stuff does actually matter.
Yeah.
It's not enough, but it's important.
No, but it is good to hear that it matters, because I think sometimes you get so many petitions sent your way or actions and you go, does this matter? Obviously, you'd like to think that signing the petition can sort of fix everything, but it is good to know that it matters, even if it doesn't do, even if it isn't as powerful as you would love it to be. But it is good to know it matters.
It matters at scale. I don't want people to think that they can do all their politics from a keyboard, but yes, it does matter at scale.
Well, thank you, too. I appreciate your time today. I know you have a lot going on, and I really personally appreciate this, because this is a case that I've been trying to follow very closely.
Thanks, Kamau.
Thank you, Kamau. It was a pleasure.
Thanks again to our guests, Ben and Bahar, and thanks to you for listening. And remember, friends, friends help friends stay in the fight. Join us, ACLU.org. You didn't need to know that, but I told you anyway. And if you enjoyed listening to this episode of At Liberty, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. It really means a lot to us. Give us 5 stars. We're doing the big work here. Until next time, I'm your host, W. Kamau Bell. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU. This episode was executive produced by the ACLU's Jessica Herman-Weitz and Gwen Schroeder, and Who Knows Best Productions, me, Kelly Rafferty, PhD, and Melissa Hudson-Bell, PhD, and was recorded at the Great Skyline Studios in Oakland, California. What's up, Brian? This show is edited and produced by Erica Ghetto and Mariah Gossett for Good Get.